Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Hey, Paul. Did you survive Thanksgiving? It looks like you survived Thanksgiving.
I did. I grew like a turkey here.
I was going to say, your chair is kind of sitting a little lower than usual.
We have a show that runs in the morning here called The City Square, and they play this funny game called Is It a Law? And they always have these goofy laws. And the one law they said, is it a law that airlines have to have a certain width on the seats? And no, it isn't. They could get them down to 10 inches. I thought, how horrible. Everybody's getting bigger in the bottom there. And that's certainly the way I feel after Thanksgiving here.
You and I have never talked about this, but this is kind of like just leaning design-wise. You know that schools are having to be built larger?
Really?
In order for classroom, not because the number of people in the classroom, although that obviously is an ongoing discussion about, you know, how many people can you fit, blah, blah, blah. But because the furniture for the kids is having to be built larger.
Wow.
Because of the obesity that we have in children.
Reality.
So then manifests to a larger school building that basically, you know, it's just fascinating that we live in a culture that abundance of that nature is almost like against our own best interest at this point. You know, it's like all this food, and we had a Thanksgiving, and as I get older, my digestive system is not as user-friendly as usual. So
Welcome to aging.
We have to do, of course, you know, we went to my mother-in-law in the morning for breakfast,
sure.
Right? And then we went to my parents and my sister. Actually, my mom was overseas, so we picked her up from the airport. I was at LAX the day before Thanksgiving.
Oh, yikes.
Okay.
That's
the nightmare of being on the freeway that day, right?
Yeah. Nightmare of travel on those days.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It was really a disaster. And then so we were at my sister's, but I was full just when I woke up in the morning and realized I have to eat a lot that day, you know, just let alone. Where were you? Were you at your house or where did you go?
As I've mentioned before, I inherited a home from my father when he passed away a couple years ago out in Palm Springs, out in the Sun City out there. So we rented and then we periodically go out there for the holidays because it's fun. There's a pool and everything. And so we were out there with my 92-year-old aunt who's still alive out there and my whole small clan here.
That's very cool.
My daughter and her fiance and their baby and my wife and my son.
So Sun City is still where all the boomers go now.
I don't know. My wife goes.
Is that a Del Webb? I think that's a Del Webb, isn't it?
Isn't that
Del Webb? Yeah.
It's a beautiful place, and she hates it because there's too many old people. And I said, look around. They're younger than we are here. So.
Oh, that's funny. But her attitude is still there's a lot of old people around. That's pretty funny. So yeah. So how old does she see herself as?
Oh, she's the same as me. We're both like 30. When we look in the mirror, we're in our late 20s or early 30s somewhere, and we'll be forever.
We're going to ask you the same question, Jerry. We ask this all the time, right? It's funny how in our own minds we're a certain age. When other people look at us, they see us in a different way. And I tell Paul, you know, if he thinks he's 30, then I'm in trouble because I'm not out of high school yet. Right?
It is a state of mind.
It is a state of mind.
Definitely.
And I don't know why different people pick different stages, but for me, that's I'll always be
nostalgic
that.
Memory, maybe of
yeah,
some
I
sort,
guess so.
The good times. Okay, well,
rock and roll.
I'm just going to say I'm impressed, Paul, that you actually paired our show beginning ad with our guest.
See how that just happened?
We're just that sophisticated around here. We're just, you know, we've
got
all we're on the.
We
sound like we don't know what we're doing, but we actually do. With that, I will just say our guest today and. I've been waiting for this for a long time.
A very famous guest.
A very famous guest, actually. I shuddered to write words like icon and, you know, pillar of the community when I was actually doing the little, you know, teaser on social media. But Jerry Rosen, who a lot of people know and whose efforts and organizations and just philanthropy and volunteerism and, you know, working wardrobe, I know has helped a lot of people I know. And you guys are celebrating, is it 25 years this year?
It's 25 years, and I think I want to celebrate for 2 years, honestly, Rod. I've had such a great time celebrating and kind of a walk down memory lane for 25 years and
that's
what we've
attitude.
Done. Why not?
We're
it's
okay
what Disneyland
with it.
Does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Disneyland celebrate for
exactly.
2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but people tell you, you know, I'm 39 again, right? So I'm celebrating 25
Isn't
year
Sinatra,
anniversary.
Aren't they celebrating Frank Sinatra's 100th?
100 years, you're right.
He would have been 100 if he was alive. And so they're doing parties, and I know Palm Springs are making a big deal, but I think there's some network special coming up about it. And
really?
Yeah, so they're the same thing. They're going to celebrate over a prolonged
period of time. He
would have been 100? His son has actually taken a show on the road to honor his father's legacy in music, mm-hmm. and it's the 100-year anniversary of Frank Sinatra.
See, that's amazing. That just blows me away. I don't even think of Frank like that,
It would have been 100.
Unbelievable. And probably still singing in Vegas.
Yeah. And doing it his way.
And doing it his way. Very nice, Jerry. I like that.
Exactly.
So, Jerry, we always start the show by saying, and you are going to do it more justice than I ever will, give us a little background. Like, how did you find yourself, looking back from this perspective of not only 25 years of working wardrobe, but, you know, being so involved and volunteering and giving back to the community, did you see yourself being in this spot way back? How did you find yourself?
You know, I'd like to say that I was that visionary, honestly, that I had this in mind. But the truth of the matter is this is an accidental nonprofit organization. I had no plans to run a nonprofit. My background is in marketing and advertising. Mm-hmm. I had my own ad agency. Loved it. Loved the creative process. I did do a little volunteer work on the side. I was on a board of directors of another nonprofit organization with some friends, and we were all entrepreneurs. We love giving back our skill to the nonprofit world. And I'm going to write about this in my book. I don't mention the name of the nonprofit organization, but it was a nonprofit that believed that volunteers would get their thanks when they got to heaven. Mm. And so it wasn't important to say thank you for the great work that you've done. And we just did everything, PR campaigns, promotional campaigns, and so forth. And I thought, you know what, I'm actually getting more gratitude from my clients than I am from this volunteer work.
Wow.
But we loved giving back to the community. And so we left the board, and one of my friends gave me an article about a woman in North Carolina who had her own retail store. And she would put clothes in the attic that didn't sell and make them available for women who were in a battered shelter. If they needed to go to court or to an interview, they would have some clothes. And we thought, 25 years ago, nobody talked about battered women.
Right.
We barely talk about it today.
Yeah.
But I loved the idea of helping someone renew their self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like a fairly simple idea. I went home and I wrote a marketing plan, because that's kind of the way I think.
Yeah.
And we said, well, we don't have a store. Let's do an event. And so we spent nearly a year putting an event together that would provide a skills assessment for each of the women, an opportunity to have their hair done and their makeup done, and then to have personal shoppers help them pick out outfits. And we were only going to do it once. And that's exactly how I pitched it to my friends. Let's just do this great event one time, and then we'll all go back and we'll go back to our work.
It's funny. You know, you touch on so many things that are sort of almost repetitive, either pitfalls or benefits of being involved in a nonprofit situation or a volunteer situation, right? One of them that you started off with is this sense of not getting a thank you or a sense of acknowledgement, that it's usually the kiss of death. I mean, a lot of people just need that. I mean, as human beings, I think we need that reassurance. The other aspect of it is that you never, ever, from my experience, get somebody to volunteer on an open-ended situation. You always define the fact that there is a beginning and an end to the task you're asking them to engage in.
Right.
So I'm actually laughing, because when you say, I sold it to my friends as being a one-time
one-off
event, I'm going, brilliant, of course you would do that. Even if it was going to happen for 20 years, you would never say that to them at the beginning. So what happened after that one event?
It was such a celebration at that event. We did two events in a day. We had 67 women who came to the basement of Brinderson Towers and let us work on them. And they were so courageous. I mean, we really weren't quite sure what we were doing.
How did you find them?
How did they find you?
Yeah. We found where the safe shelters were, and we made contacts with them. And women agreed that, yes, they'll come and do this. And the people that ran Brinderson Towers were so delightful to us. We set up bar stools in the men's room and in the ladies' room and did hair and makeup, and had a tiny little room for wardrobing. But it was the spirit of the volunteers that was so extraordinary. And they were hands-on touching these women and helping them transform their lives. And just to see that, it's exactly what we do today. That same sense of transformation, that same sense of celebration is what has been with us for 25 years. And it's why volunteers love doing the work with us.
I'm sure, yeah.
Not always do you have a chance to actually affect the people that are being served by your organization.
In fact, and we talked about it every once in a while, is in fact we are in a society that is very in contact but not really connected.
We are very high touch.
Yeah, so that is, and again, I mentioned to you before we started the show that I do a lot of like day spas, medical spas, and resort spas. That is an aspect of sort of the wellness in the spa industry that we always talk about. We actually jokingly, we did a show where we were live from Vegas with the chairman of the International Spa Association, who's a friend of mine, Michael Tompkins. And we laugh at how that when you go to a conference for International Spa Association, you pretty much are hugged. From the minute you walk into the ballroom all the way through the 4 or 5 days that you're there, you know, it's pretty much a hug fest that happens to have some vendors involved, right? And so, yeah, we live in a society where that element of touch, that healing aspect of it, that supportive aspect, that shoring up aspect of it, is something that it's sad to think of, but a lot of people maybe not have in their life, especially if they are in a battered situation or an abusive situation.
And especially as we age.
Yes. And I think as seniors in assisted living and so forth, I hear similar pattern stories.
I'm going to give you two
disconnect.
Two examples. One, we mentioned on the show a long time ago, my mother, before she got Parkinson's and really fell apart, she used to do a lot of volunteer with animals. And one of the things she did, which is now pretty common, is take animals to senior homes. Mm-hmm. And the reality of how people respond who haven't touched a cat or a dog in years or had somebody sit on their lap or lick their face or whatever is just unbelievable because they live they're stored, their warehouse.
It's an arm's length existence.
Yeah. And then the other one, I think I mentioned the show as well. I saw this strange movie I'd never heard of a while ago on late night television. I think it was on HBO or something. And it was called Wrestling with Hemingway. And it was about two seniors, one of which was Robert Duvall and the other was the great Richard Harris. And they're totally different people, but they're alone. And they come to need each other and they come to rely on each other. And Duvall plays a barber. And so one of the things he does after they become friends, these two guys, he says, let me cut your hair. He says, no, nobody cuts my hair anymore. I haven't done that in years. And he finally gets him to cut his hair, and Richard Harris breaks down and starts crying.
Weeping.
Somebody's touching him. Somebody cares about how he looks.
Mm-hmm. It takes me back to the very first year that we served men in one of our signature events, our career success graduations. We've been doing that for 18 years. And we added doing manicures for the men. Mm-hmm. Very controversial for the men, male volunteers. They said, oh, no man is going to want a manicure. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, maybe they don't. Let's offer it. If they want it, that would be great. We were serving at that time men who had been formerly incarcerated, men who had been through addiction and in recovery. And there was a man who came out of the manicure salon, probably in his late 50s, early 60s, and he had tears streaming down his cheeks. And I said, oh, sir, did something happen? Mm-hmm. And he said, I haven't had the soft touch of a woman in 8 years.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And he had just had his first manicure.
Somebody held his hand.
Yeah. And it was for him just the most remarkable experience. And we've added massage therapy to our events because that's very important. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we still do the manicures and the massage. And there are men who said, if I have to choose between a haircut and a manicure, I'll take the manicure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That is really remarkable for them.
Mm-hmm. That really is.
Yeah, no, interesting enough, we have this same conversation relevant to just, you know, who the end user would be in spas. And I see also a generational switch. And we start talking about things sort of being made a little bit more palatable because of generations before us kind of breaking through that barrier or that ceiling. One of the things that's happening right now is that there is actually an increased acceptance on things like that, like where men are the boundaries are breaking or they're merging. You know, men are a little bit more wellness aware. They're a little bit more.
They're more touchy,
more than just going to a gym and actually just working out. There's also the caring aspect of it, the touching aspect of it, that openness. And it's fascinating. I did a store for men's grooming products for a company. We did a concept for them this year, and we just finished. That's how I spent my Thanksgiving. We actually were putting in one at Burbank Airport in like a week.
Oh, yeah,
we executed
that, right?
One in a week, right? And it's fascinating because we experience people in their 16-year-olds that are growing a beard for the first time and people that are 60 that have had a beard forever, right? And whereas
Why are you looking at me when you said that?
Well, 60 and have had a beard forever. But, you know, where women have had that awareness of the importance of maintaining and caring for themselves and others.
Personal
grooming.
Especially
men, that is a language that is very new to us, but it's really refreshing and hopeful when you see it from 16 to 60 taking hold now. Because I really believe that what you and how you see yourself in the mirror and what you do to take care of yourself, then you then have within you the ability to express that to others. Without that, we as a society continue to be disconnected. We don't have a vulnerability that we're willing to show to
Absolutely.
Others or reach out and help somebody, you know, to put ourselves out of that
and
comfort
to let
level.
Yourself be touched. My father would never let anybody touch him till the much later in life here. He was a good, tough Midwesterner, grew up in the Great Depression, the World War II generation, and he, you know, you didn't touch my dad. You didn't kiss him or hug him or anything here. And then I was a little more touchy-feely, but I'm still a Midwesterner at heart here, and I come out to California, everybody wants to hug you all the time. I'm like, I don't even know you. You're going to hug me and everything. Now I think it's changed. I think people are getting much more open to that idea. And amen, because isn't that what we all need to connect us to everybody again here?
I think there is a lot of that that's true, but I will tell you that on a daily basis we work with a lot of people who feel invisible.
Oh, yeah.
And these are people who probably don't see themselves in the mirror because they don't want to see themselves. And they don't.
They're afraid of what they may see.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they don't like what they might see in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And it is important for them to regain the sense of dignity
mm-hmm.
and to take pride in who they are again. We work with a lot of veterans. And when a veteran who has had so much pride in serving our country mm-hmm. and learning skills comes back to this country and loses that sense of self and that sense of dignity,
purpose and value, yeah.
it's devastating.
Yeah.
But we can also turn it around, and they work very hard in turning that around.
It's interesting when you say invisible. I'm related to one other thing that maybe isn't directly related to the show, but as I mentioned to you beforehand, I adopted a little girl from Mexico out of foster care when she was 10. And the first thing we asked her was, you know, she didn't know how to match clothes or anything. She didn't have any clothes, so whatever she had, she just wore. There was no sense of fashion or any how she looked or anything. And she said, I said, well, how did you live and how did you do all this stuff for the first 10 years of life? And she said, I felt invisible. And I thought, wow, that just struck me. When you said that again, it was like, because my whole life, I never felt invisible. I dare say Rod didn't feel invisible. I might have felt happy or sad or whatever, but I never experienced feeling invisible, that nobody saw me, that there was nobody there to care for me.
No, I don't even know where to begin to feel that way, and it's unfortunate, right?
I think there are people in foster care feel invisible. I think there are people in veterans that come back suddenly feel invisible. I think there's seniors certainly feel invisible. I know there is an invisible poor in this county that we seem to somehow not see and walk around and ignore, whatever, the people living in hotels and other places here.
I saw something, and I'm not trying to be controversial, but you know, I saw a few. I've been kind of watching the situation with even the refugees. You know, I mean, these are people that are invisible and at risk, majorly at risk.
Nobody
right?
sees them. Nobody cares. Nobody wants
to
see them.
You know, the fact that we constantly talk about the need for more housing and more of this nature that's affordable in Orange County. You know, we that if we don't do it, we're actually suffering because you're going to end up with a community and a county that doesn't have the diversity across socioeconomic lines, across age, you know,
right.
the younger people that are basically starting on their path of life. And this is not at risk necessarily. This is just simply, I cannot afford to live in Orange County.
Right. We're losing right? millennials.
And we're losing those people that are potential leaders of the future, you know,
right.
people that are going to contribute. I think when it comes to society, sometimes the most important things, like touch, like vulnerability, that connection that really is meaningful, seems to not really get prioritized.
Mm-mm.
That it's the other stuff, it's the pursuit, it's the goals, it's the getting that job, it's that getting that material thing. When at the end of the day, do you really care to hug your car? But yet your neighbor, do you know them?
Do you even know what
they're going through? Do you even know that they may be somebody in their family just suffered a stroke over Thanksgiving and they basically were devastated and, you know, all you saw was their closed door and the manicured lawn? I mean, how many people do you really, I'm not saying people are bad, but how many people really get out of their own comfort zone?
their own bubble.
To reach out, unless it is through an organization like yours, which provides them an opportunity to maybe do so in their own right in a safe place.
So that must be a popular reason to volunteer with your organization. I would think once people experience that, I'm not raising funds for XYZ disease that's needed and that will get put into research, but I'm actually touching somebody.
We started many, many years ago with chapters of the National Charity League. So this is moms and daughters who...
Sure.
For the most part, come from wealthy families, and many of the moms wanted their daughters to experience life outside the bubble.
The bubble, uh-huh.
To have an opportunity to work with women or with young teenagers who don't have a chance to go to the mall with their moms and spend hundreds of dollars and five hours looking for something was really enlightening for them to see that not everybody has those opportunities. Not everybody has a mother and a father and lives in a nice home. More importantly for us these days, we're working with many companies who are sending volunteer teams to us and doing corporate social responsibilities.
Absolutely.
For exactly those same reasons. Companies can invest in this community. Companies invest in nonprofit organizations, and they can do that. We'd love to have them do that with money. We'd love to have them do that with their volunteer teams. And the teams can have so much morale boosting and bonding when they go out and do a volunteer day.
Right, they take the benefit of that beyond just the volunteering opportunity. You're right, absolutely.
And I'm perfect segue to another part of my family. I'm always sharing everything about all my family, my life, and my wife.
Well, I've said this is really not my show.
Yeah,
it's your therapy session.
It's my therapy session. I get to work all this out. My wife works for U.S. Bank. A shout out for U.S. Bank. She was a branch manager.
Wonderful sponsor of ours. Thank you so much,
and
Paul.
I was shocked. Again, I confess, for many years, I didn't even know that your organization existed. And then I started the station a couple years ago, and one of our show hosts, Chris Dyer from the Talent Talk, says, well, you know, I said, well, you got to run a couple commercials. If you don't have them, we'll get some PSAs. He said, well, I know one we got to run. We got to run Working Wardrobes. And I'm like, okay. And then we start playing your spot. And then all of a sudden, my wife comes home and she says, well, what are you doing with this bag? Well, I'm putting it together for Working Wardrobes. Really? And suddenly, I started hearing this thing over and over and over again.
You surrounded you, Paul.
You surrounded me. I was in a bubble. I was not paying attention. You were there, and I was not hearing it. And now, in many ways, you've come to my attention over the last couple of years. And when my father passed away. We took all his suits and all his clothes that I couldn't wear. He was a different size. And we took him to your facility over by John Wayne Airport. You have somewhere over there, I think.
Just right on Pullman and Baker. And thank you for that. Because, you know, Paul, that's what happens. Those clothes are going to have another life, and they're going to help somebody get back to work.
And that would
make him happy. Of course, it'll make him.
Yeah. He had dozens of suits. I never wear a suit, and they were beautiful clothes. And he was only 5'10". I'm 6'4", so I could never wear them, even if I wanted to. And I thought, what would make him happy was to see those suits that he took such pride in.
Yeah.
You know, he came from that era, that Rat Pack era, where the way you dressed, as my father used to say, put on a suit and, boy, just go out and you're a whole different person in the world here. We put those to work.
So you put those to work. So they continue to give.
That wardrobe is still working.
Yeah, yeah. That nice little.
Yeah. Yeah,
but where do you get your volunteers from? Do you even have to go out and get them? I mean, I would think at this point they're knocking on your doors just trying to...
Well, there are over 4,000 people a year who find us, and we love every one of them, and we need every one of them.
Well done, yeah.
For us as an organization serving close to 5,000 clients, men, women, young adults, and veterans, with a staff in our offices of about 25 people, we must have an engine that is run by volunteers. And our volunteers are every age. They may be 16, they may be 70, they may be 80 years old. What is really important these days in the nonprofit world is the skills-based volunteer, the professional skills volunteer. Those people who are newly retired, who just have the skill set that any nonprofit needs, whether it's in finance or in marketing or in
legal,
whatever the topic is.
Yeah, absolutely.
They bring a professionalism to the organization that is greatly needed. And so a shout out to anyone who is transitioning to retirement years or newly retired. Once they've cleaned out their homes and straightened out every closet and every drawer.
And played golf and traveled
for
a year and done whatever they're going
to
do. Yeah.
We want to give them something to do.
Well, I'll add to that one other aspect. And I don't think it's necessarily just sort of people of that retirement age. But I know that for me, and I've been involved in nonprofits on multiple boards at least for the last decade, if not a little bit longer. And in all different capacities, there was an organization called Rebuilding Together that had an Orange County chapter.
Yes.
we have since closed that chapter, but my wife is actually involved in their Long Beach chapter, another, you know, sort of like a Habitat for Humanity kind of organization, although Rebuilding Together is going to smack me for saying they're like a Habitat. But,
and vice versa.
But right. But, and then the Historical Society in San Clemente and so forth and so on. And I will say this.
Ronald McDonald House.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. Another great organization. The cool thing about volunteering and being involved in that capacity is it really feeds your soul in a manner that I don't care how much passion you have for your job, it just will not feed it the same way. And it's not so much the, I mean, I tell people, I volunteer because I'm selfish. I want to feed my soul. And they go, oh, selfish, volunteer, the two words shouldn't go together. And I go, why? Because it's really, I really want to give to myself in a manner that feeds an aspect of my personality, my soul, that a job isn't going to.
I think selfish is good. I think selfish says that you're taking care of who you are.
Absolutely.
And
couldn't agree more.
And there's more of you available in the world when you make that happen.
Absolutely.
It really is true. And I think volunteers are, it's such a distinctly American outreach, isn't it?
It is. It really is. I mean, I think it exists in other cultures, but not in this. It's such a genuine, authentic form of involvement that actually I think is somewhat uniquely United States.
That's a very interesting statement I've never heard and never thought of before. You obviously were born overseas, Rod, and lived in throughout the Middle East in different places.
Yeah.
So you can speak to that area. I've never really been out of this country much except once or twice to Europe or Mexico or something, so I can't really speak to it. But is it really an American phenomenon?
I think so, and I'll tell you why. I think a lot of organizations, and I think part of the problems that other places have is because of a lack of this, is a lot of countries do not have the infrastructure for giving and caring in this nonprofit, in this volunteer capacity. It's all either dependent on government or some sort of social programs or things of that nature, if they even exist, right? And so people are kind of left to their own devices, their own survival skills in a lot of cases. And here, from the very, very beginning, I think the American culture included this element of giving thanks. We just had Thanksgiving, right? The spirit of this. And I think, not to be kind of religious about it, but I think if you look at the foundation of the country and the people that came over from the old world and what it was that they brought with them, there was a sense of religious persecution, and but you still had sort of that giving, that kind of, I'm not taking away from any other religion, but sort of that Christian appeal to support, to shore up your brother kind of thing.
Right.
And I think that got so infused into the American culture. I jokingly say in San Clemente that, you know, between every nonprofit and nonprofit, there's a nonprofit, right? I mean, you would basically trip over nonprofits trying to get...
Somebody told me there's like 3,000 of registered nonprofits in the county alone.
And actually, there are over 11,000.
11,000?
Yeah. There are 3,000 that are considered sustainable.
Sustainable nonprofits.
Over 500,000.
Right. Wow.
But I think part of what is the draw for volunteerism is that there's actually a spiritual sense about you when you're volunteering. So not necessarily religious, but the fact
spiritual.
That there's this overarching spiritual sense, you are doing something, you're getting your soul is fed by volunteering.
Well, I'll say this, when we adopted our daughter, and we're good Irish Catholics, so first we felt a calling kind of to help somebody, but I did it for the most selfish of reasons. I didn't want to be alone. I wanted to share. I wanted to have a child and give back. And people sometimes see, I'm sure with anybody that does good in somebody else's eyes, I think there's a selfish component to it that is good about it, and it helps feed you.
And to Jerry's point, I think the word selfish has been maligned to a certain extent, because if you don't give to yourself, how do you have to give to others?
Right.
I think we'll take a break, Paul.
Let's do that.
Okay.
If you are like the majority of Americans, you want to continue living in a familiar environment throughout your maturing years. In fact, according to many surveys, 82% of homeowners overwhelmingly prefer to age in place, which means living in their current homes safely, independently, and comfortably, regardless of age or ability level. With over 30 years of combined experience in residential, commercial, hospitality, and destination resorts fields, Your Home for a Lifetime is a company dedicated to empowering you to maintain your quality of life and independence by helping you make your house your home for a lifetime. Do you want to reorganize or remodel your home? Do you want to add a full bathroom and possibly a bedroom on the main floor? Are you looking to make your kitchen more functional? Is an aging parent moving in, or your child is moving out, or even moving back in? Call your home for a lifetime at 949-492-1872 or check them out on the web at yourhomeforalifetime.com and find out how they can help you make your house your home for a lifetime.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest. Higher.
And we're back.
There is a question we appreciate, by the way. I want to give a shout out to Angela Jacobson, Splash Media, who sent us a set of questions in case we would find ourselves at a loss
at
for
a
having
loss,
a conversation.
Wondering what
no
to say.
I think that's pretty much a given. There was one question that just jumped at me, and I think what jumped at me was just the way that the wording was, right? And I'm going to ask you this coming right out of the break.
Okay.
What is the fuel that keeps your engine humming along, which I thought was interesting. It wasn't like, what's the passion for you in this? Or it was the fuel that kept the engine humming.
It
so
keeps
Jerry,
the fire what, burning.
How is your engine kept humming? What is the fuel?
You know, honestly, the fuel is volunteerism. 4,000 people willing to just give us their time and their talent every day is exactly what keeps us moving along.
How do you handle
it?
Hold on.
We were nice the first part of that show.
All right.
Now I'm getting a little...
Oh, you're
going to
get...
Okay.
After the break, we've loosened her up.
I understand that may be sort of the sustainable fuel for the organization, but I'm asking you specifically to you, what is it that makes you continue to be engaged in this?
And we ended
the first half as talking about selfish being a good thing, right? So
right.
What is it that gives you... For being, it's 25 years. I mean, that's an amazing timeline to be involved in something like this. And I don't see you slowing down either. From what I hear, you're just like, okay, what am I going to do next?
Second right? 25 is in the wings.
Exactly.
That's right. You know what? Honestly, Rod, this is joyful work. And when you see someone who has had nothing in his or her life and is in such a bad place, who is working hard to get out of that place, and you can give them some tools, and you can give them some encouragement, and you can also put them in a great-looking outfit that they never thought they would ever have or thought they would ever deserve. It just is so rewarding. And I get paid to do this. And then we work hard to raise money, but the fact that we have a staff that is excited every day and dedicated every day to make this happen, I couldn't ever say, no, I don't want to do this.
And what is it that happens? Tell us, somebody comes in and they're down on their luck. They're getting off of drugs. They're homeless. They're a veteran that's thinking of killing himself.
Right.
All these horrible people, they're poor, they're homeless. All this group that's floating around invisible to most of us. And they find you, walk in, and you dress them up. The simplest of gestures. What
happens?
Well,
actually, that's the last thing that we do.
Right.
Okay.
What we're really working hard on is assessing who the client is. We have case management that is working directly with the clients, particularly with our veterans. We need to find out the story behind every face. And
that's powerful.
And
the story behind every face, right? Because we think this is a storytelling medium. We'd love to have you bring in some of these stories.
Well, it's an individual story, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
they're all different.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all different. And so then an individual employment plan is put together for each person. What is it that you want to do? Mm-hmm. What skill set do you have? Or what new skill set do you want to adopt and you want to move forward with in your life?
Mm-hmm.
Then we find the training programs and the workshops that are going to be putting you on that path. But the last process is putting them in a good-looking suit so they're going to shine in an interview. But all along the way, we've got to give them the tools and the techniques so they're going to be successful in that interview.
Right, because if your level of self-esteem, your sense of comfort in your own skin, it doesn't matter what the outfit you're wearing is, it's not going to basically give you that sense of confidence.
We don't want an empty suit out there. We want somebody inside that suit that is powerful and feeling confident. And even though this is a much more casual environment, we want to have our clients out there with suits on because that makes a statement to an interviewer. This is someone who's earnest and sincere about wanting to go back to work.
So was my father right? Do clothes make the man?
No. It's the man inside the suit. But that helps. that suit, that good-looking suit, certainly helps because they stand differently and they feel differently.
Carry themselves differently, yeah. That's the way my father always said. You and I would debate. I've never worn a suit. I hate suits. I'm a hippie, you know, all that. I dress down rather than dress up.
You know,
and yet that's coming back in a big way. Feeling good, looking good, being sharp, the Rat Pack ethic.
Well,
you know.
And we are. I mean, let's just face it, right? Right or wrong, we are very much a visual-driven society.
Very much so.
Right? And looks do have a certain evaluation. In some cases, it may give somebody an opportunity to give somebody a second chance to look deeper or closer at them, or not.
That's exactly the point, because our clients have so many barriers to their success and to their employment. We don't want to have that visual barrier be something that they can't overcome. If they can look the part, then they can have somebody drill down a little deeper and ask them the questions.
I saw something yesterday on Facebook, and it was a little video, okay? Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, where looks could be deceiving kind of thing, right? There's like four African-American gentlemen that were walking in what seemed to be a... I mean, again, I'm relating to when I was in Atlanta. It looked like it was somewhere in the South. It was sort of not antebellum homes, but homes of that nature. And they came to a door, and it was very much Norman Rockwell's, a red painted door with the wreath on it and everything. And they're all in black, and I'm not picking on the team, but Raiders clothes, right? Okay. Even though we're in Orange County.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, dressed like that, and heavy a little bit, and to be a little bit, you know, maybe Urban Dictionary kind of, you know, a little hipster-ish, but a little thuggish as well. What they did is they put a camera right on top of the door frame, and then they knocked onto this door. And the lady opens the door, and they're sitting there, and one of them actually kind of overdid it. He kind of puts his hand kind of inside his jacket, right?
Reaching
for his clock, right? And so she's like, opens the door, and then closes the door, and she's like, oh my, and you can only imagine what she's thinking inside the house, right? And they're still standing there. And then they break out in carol.
Rap caroling, huh?
Right. They break out in carol, like, you know. And she opens the door, and she stands outside the door eventually, leaning on the door. And you could see her sense of embarrassment and amazement and all that at the same time. And yet this was just what? Based on what? Looks.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Then let me ask the question, which I...
So it is very important.
Is it equally important for men and women, or is it more important for women?
No, it's equally important. Yeah. And frankly, I think in some respects, even more important for men.
Yeah.
And it used to be that we had the time to open up that door. We had the time to get into a dialogue. We have maybe 2 or 3 seconds to make that first impression these days. It's a blink, you know, the book.
Absolutely.
Blink. Yep. You've got a blink of an eye to really say, I want to talk with this person, I want to spend some more time with this person, or I don't.
Right.
And we don't want that to at all ever
be. And that time's getting shorter, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the attention span is like, we all have ADD.
We live in a 140 right. character world here where you got to tell me on Twitter what's.
Although I did hear that Google now is basically wanting longer verbiage. So we've kind of, the pendulum swinging the other way. It's like 1,200. I asked somebody the other day about writing an article for them, and they said, well, how many words? And I expected 400 to 500.
Yeah, no, they're
1,200 to 1,600.
Which is, I'm going to say for our industry, part of what the power of podcast is in a world where everything's getting shorter and more condensed, 30 seconds on a website, they're a minute of a video of 140 characters in Twitter. This is long form storytelling. Look how long we've gone on here. And people will listen to it perhaps because they're stuck in a car.
Some may think too long.
No, never. and the Columbia School of Journalism did a study on this, and they said the power of podcasting is it's amazing. In a world where everything's getting shorter, people will give you 30, 40, 50 minutes. Maybe because they're stuck in a car, maybe because they're at an airport or at the gym and they've got time to kill. But at the same time, it's reinventing long-form storytelling.
Well, we were just talking, right? It's about having a conversation.
Getting to know people.
People used to sit around the dinner table
and do this,
and actually catch up with their lives, right? Now they sit on the dinner table and they're still talking to each other via their devices.
People used to go to a restaurant and talk. Now they sit and stare at their little gadgets and gadgets for...
You see it happen all the time. It's amazing. That's why I said, you know, people are in contact, but the depth of connection across the board is less and less. Your attention span and the visuals are less and less. But I'm going to ask a question because relevant to the interview process, okay? We also hear, and I've experienced myself, is that the interview process used to be an in-person situation. This day and age, the interview process, you're
starts
lucky
online,
if you get to that point because it's all submit your resume online, you get weeded literally by robot computer or whatever, and then how does that affect what you do? Because you're dressing people up and preparing them for an interview. But this new barrier
all of that is the work that we're doing inside the client, and with their resume, they've got to have the right words for the search engine to pop up the jobs that they're looking for. It takes almost 2 hours to do an online application these days.
Yeah.
And
wow.
It's difficult. There's no question about it. One of the things that we train our clients to talk about is not to look for the job, but to find out from that interviewer, what are the issues in their company? What are the problems that they're wrestling with that they might help them solve? It's really switching that whole dynamic.
Yeah.
It's not, give me a job. This is what I want.
Right.
But how can I help you and your company resolve these issues?
Which was old, as long as I can remember, that was the way to get traction. Because you basically look like you did your homework, and you basically are coming in as, in a lot of cases, even in just general communication with people, if you are the person that's coming in with solutions and you're offering freely that giving and volunteerism kind of aspect we talked about, then you're likely to get a little bit of traction, looked at differently.
And you ask questions. You pull things out of people rather than just sit there and say yes or no.
You've done your homework. You've done the research.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't sit in an interview and say, tell me a little bit about how this company was started.
Yeah, what's this company and why am I here? Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to go back to that one point and just hit it again, though. And again, on Chris's show, Talent Talk, they've talked about this a lot. I didn't know this. In a world of online interviews, in a world of online submissions, there are, as Rod suggested, robots sorting these things.
Oh, yeah.
And if you don't have the right keywords in your resume, in your application, they don't look at your picture. They don't meet you. You get thrown out before you ever get a chance to come in.
You know, this is one of the greatest issues that face our veterans that are coming out of the military.
Absolutely.
They're not prepared with a civilian world resume.
Mm-hmm.
Even the language, their MOS, what they've done in the military, all of that needs to be translated into civilian speak. And that is one of the things that we've really become experts at, because that resume has to be their lead-in. We actually had a veteran client who circled down into homelessness in less than 6 months when he left the military.
Oh, wow.
He didn't have a resume. And he just thought, look at all I've done in the military. I've been in charge of logistics. I've moved mountains. People wanted a resume, and he didn't understand what the language was all about.
Or how to transfer verbiage-wise what it is that he had to offer to a civilian, if you will, employee.
English from military.
Well, I do want to give a shout-out because, you know, we had Jerry lined up to be on the show a while back, and, you know, things happen. And you guys actually suggested a gentleman that came in here, and specifically we talked about this, Mr. Josh Newman, who I believe is running for office now.
Yes, he is.
Right. And
fascinating.
So I'm giving a shout-out for Josh. He's an amazing guy. Thank you so much for suggesting him. Loved the time spent with him. And he was involved, I don't know if he's still involved, but he had set up a nonprofit called Armed Force to Workforce.
Right.
Okay. And that's exactly what they were doing. And we talked about some of that stuff, that not only is it the veteran that needs help in re-deciphering what they did and what it is that they have to offer, but also the employer has to be educated at the fact that these people have something to offer worth looking at.
Yes, absolutely. And unfortunately, the media paints the picture of a veteran who is typically with PTSD and going to be
screwed up, explosive, going to blow up,
a challenge to be brought into the
world. There are greater incidence of PTSD in the civilian population than there ever will be in the veteran population.
Okay. Thank you.
And
yes.
Anyone who's been in an accident, who's gone through trauma, is going to experience that. There's so much value that our veterans have and can bring to a company, no question about it. And we can't blame the military. They're not in the business of preparing their active duty to become active in the civilian world. But we've got to be closer to that time frame when they're leaving the military to do the best job for them, because they can, as I mentioned, become homeless very quickly. And many of the active duty that are not married are almost at a loss for what they're going to do and where they're going to go.
Yeah.
There are some issues facing our veterans that are really significant. And Orange County and the state of California face that in great numbers.
Do you think we even, as a society, really have a clue at just how much of this issue really
is? Or is this invisible again?
Yeah. Or is it again an invisible thing?
We honestly, Rod, we have no idea as civilians how deep this problem is and how pervasive it is. I mean, we don't even know in the civilian population. We have 240,000 people in Orange County who are underemployed.
Mm-hmm.
People living in our community who are cobbling together two and three jobs just to stay afloat.
Living on the edge, literally on the razor's edge every
and
day.
One thing goes wrong and the whole life can just
We had Nicole evaporate. On this morning, the chief executive officer. I don't know how to say her last name.
Sadiam.
And she's the CEO of Second Harvest Food Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And in a county of 3 million people, similar to what you said, 300,000 of them aren't sure where their next meal's coming from.
Right.
They're food unsure, as they classify them.
And, you know, this is...
Uncertain.
This is the same population. They're in a motel, or they've got two and three families mm-hmm. in a one- or two-bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. This is the population that is pervasive in this community, and we don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
We see South Coast Plaza and we see
right.
Disneyland, but we don't see...
Let me ask you this question, Jerry, because you would think that in a problem of this nature didn't just happen overnight, that this is a problem that has been either escalating or has always been there. We're talking about solutions or providing assistance through sort of nonprofits and private donations and volunteerism and things of that nature. Is there enough resources put towards this? From a policy or a governmental or a county level? Is it something that should have more? Are we better serving it in the capacity through nonprofits? I mean, this is a question I always struggle with, regardless what the need is, regardless of what the at-risk population is. Are we better off? And I think this is even a larger conversation than just Orange County. I think this is a conversation happening probably at the national level. Is this a situation where we need more involvement on the governmental side? Or is this something that really is best served purely from a nonprofit volunteer side, churches, examples, things like that? Just from the perspective of 25 years of doing this?
You know, I think this is truly a partnership between government and the private sector, and certainly the nonprofit community needs to come together on this. I don't know that there will ever be enough money the housing that is needed in this community.
Right,
and this
not.
Problem has escalated almost out of control with just the cost of housing.
Yeah.
A good friend of mine is the CEO at Habitat for Humanity, and we talk about this all the time. Do you need a job first? Do you need a home first? It's the chicken and the egg.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are not enough housing communities that they can build to really address the issue, and it is really pervasive in our community.
Was it this show or another show? We had somebody coming on talking about just that issue. How do you get people to get off drugs if they have no roof to over their head on a regular basis? You know, what of the many crises facing them, food, hunger, a job, money, everything
well,
else?
Well, and where to do that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we have in community after community, there's currently a very timely conversation that's taking place that has very strong feelings on both sides about sober living houses.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and things
right.
of that nature. You know, to your
group
point,
homes
well,
for a variety of things.
If society wants you to recover, but yet society doesn't want you to be in a neighborhood house in their neighborhood to recover, or if you want to basically help in a homeless, but you don't want a shelter in your own backyard, then what are you doing to actually resolving the situation other than kicking the can down the street and it's somebody else's problem? And I don't want to get on any kind of like platform here or anything of that nature, but it is, at the end of the day, there's people's lives that are being impacted.
Yeah.
There are
every
people
day.
That are falling through the cracks every day.
Every day.
And we are all a community that basically, I feel personally, should be looking out for each other. It's sad. It is a sad reality.
You know, I think there's every single nonprofit CEO who would love to say that at some point we will be out of business because the need isn't there.
Right.
I don't know of any of my colleagues who would actually believe that that's going to happen.
No, of course not.
Because the need continues to really escalate. We would love to take the entire underserved population of this community and give them more of our workshops and give them more of the tools that we can make available so they can get out of those poverty jobs and into sustainable income. That takes more money, that takes more donors to make that
right.
work available. So
right.
it's this, we continue to have more opportunities, we continue to collaborate with more organizations, we need more companies to help us. But we certainly have a community of nonprofits that are more than willing to step up every single day and do the work that
and
we can
And is there
do.
A community of nonprofits, or are they all off doing their own thing? That's one of my common fears, is that everybody, there is no coordination of efforts.
Well, we have a number of nonprofits that are very anxious and on on a daily basis collaborate. Working Wardrobes is a natural collaborative organization. Mm-hmm. We don't exist with our own clients.
Sure.
The clients come to us from the welfare to work programs or 60-some different agencies that we work with.
Right.
We do source a number of our veterans because we're on the base at Pendleton every week.
Mm-hmm.
But we look to other organizations to send us your clients so we can help them and help your organization get them on their feet and back to work.
So you're acting as a center of a spoke of some sort where you're
yes.
basically pulling other organizations
yes.
to you and collaborating. Yeah. Again, nowhere close to 25 years, from perspective of just being involved mm-hmm. sort of on the periphery compared to what Jerry does in the last decade, I will say it seems like there's more of an effort, and I think it may have been driven by the financial strains on nonprofits to try to consolidate resources and try to not repeat and replicate certain processes. The things that organizations that are similar or in relation to one another as far as their mission and their purpose, in the recent years, it seems like there's been a little bit more collaboration.
Well, there are a couple of things that are happening. There are some organizations that are merging. We've had some M&As happen in the nonprofit community. We've also had some very astute funders who've said, if you'll collaborate, mm-hmm. we'd be very happy to fund that program.
Right.
And so we, as a pretty smart nonprofit organization, are always looking for collaborative partners. That makes financial sense.
Because as we said earlier, it's a very complex problem. You've got to solve homelessness. You've got to solve hunger.
Right.
You might have to solve drug or abuse or other psychological issues. And if you just pick one of those, you're never going to really put that person
back together. Well, and corporations, I think,
together.
That are becoming more socially conscious as far as, you know, providing opportunities for their employees to volunteer, engage. I mean, let's mm-hmm. let's face it, it's smart business, right, to also be putting that face forward into the community. But at the same time, I think they're looking at it from a business perspective, and they're looking at how many organizations are going to hit me up to basically donate to, and if they have a common purpose, why can't I just donate to one center spot and have more impact? And so that's causing the nonprofit work to have to restructure itself a little bit differently.
And one other
well.
Thing that she mentioned casually, I hear over and over again, is this idea of public-private partnership. It used to be, for a while, we thought the government
social
could do it all.
Enterprise, social entrepreneurship.
Where all of a sudden these public entities are working with private entities, mm-hmm. partly because they realize they can't afford to fund it all, and they need help of private agencies, and maybe there is a more collaborative thing. How do you feel? This public-private seems to be such a powerful buzzword floating around these days.
Well, it is, but I actually want to be the advocate for social enterprises,
mm-hmm.
and because that's at least half of the revenue that Working Wardrobes brings in, and I am such a powerful voice for that. We wouldn't be here today if we didn't have the stores and the contracts that we have. And many nonprofits bring in earned income, hospitals,
yeah.
theaters, and so forth. But for us as a relatively small organization to have half of our revenue come in from our business is
wow.
really significant.
And take a minute, Jerry, because I don't think a lot of people realize when you say social enterprises that
right.
you're involved in,
it's not just
it's
people
relatively
volunteer.
A new thing in
yeah.
a lot of people.
So it's really not new. So think about this. When the monks were selling bread and wine and
the
cheese,
monks.
That was a social enterprise.
No,
so it's
no,
been
I,
around
I,
for generations.
Corrected.
But a nice, sexy title today called
but,
social enterprises.
But a lot of people don't think in their minds they connect the thing. I want you to just take a minute and be specific. Like when you say social enterprise is relevant to Working Wardrobes, what are you talking about?
We have resale stores. We have thrift shops. Look, our name says clothing,
yeah.
and we call it almost a gateway drug. People can give us clothes, and we love that because
yeah.
we're going to dress our clients. But we have clothes in excess, and so we have an opportunity to sell those clothes so that we can serve more clients.
Right.
And we now have two upscale resale boutiques in Laguna Niguel and in Tustin. We have two outlet shops in Laguna Hills and in Garden Grove. We have two thrift stores, one in Anaheim and one in Costa Mesa. We just signed a lease, and we're going to do our seventh store in Huntington Beach, and I'm looking for 8, 9, and 10.
Wonderful.
Wow.
Yes.
Wonderful.
I really love the fact that you actually have it's not just a store, that you have multiple designations, that you actually have a high-end, I love the language change too, right? But in your marketing background, I get it, right? The high-end boutique,
yes.
and then the thrift shop on the other side, and then the outlet
there
thing.
There are savvy shoppers at all levels, right?
We do not, yeah, it's not a one-size-fits-all,
that's
excuse
right.
the pun, right?
But, that's right.
Yeah, so that's very cool. How do people find you? How do people, if they don't know about you,
yeah,
how do they get involved? How do they start
here.
Getting involved?
Go
with
to
you?
The website, www.workingwardrobes.org. lots of information at the website, or call us, 714-210-2460. We welcome all donors, all volunteers, everyone to come and help.
And before we leave, there's been an invisible person in this room the whole time. We have to get her to at least acknowledge who she is.
Yes,
and why
please.
Is she sitting here?
I have the most marvelous young woman who has joined our staff as my executive assistant. And this is Janet Guerrero. Say hi, Janet.
Hello.
Hi, Janet.
So happy you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
I see. I told you we'd get you on there. Right? Nobody just sits here quietly
Nobody's
forever.
Nobody's invisible somebody gets on this show. Yeah, right.
I do want to give a shout out to a friend of mine, and I think, I'm not sure. Do you know Deborah Pearson?
I do.
Yeah, okay.
I do.
She's a friend of mine, and she's the lady that's been helping me actually scheduling guests on this show for the last 7 years.
I've known her for years. I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, and I want to congratulate her. She's just got a new job doing marketing for Caregivers Direct.
Great.
And I just, speaking of invisible people, I'm all about making sure that people get the credit that they're due, and I just wanted to say a shout out for Deborah.
And I always have to cross promote our other shows. We do this show with the Association of California Cities called the City Square on Wednesday morning, and they are putting together a homelessness OC task force at the end of January. You can go to their site and find out where they're trying to bring public and partners and private and charities together and talk about what hasn't been discussed a lot in this wealthy county.
Yesterday was Giving Tuesday.
Yeah, Giving Tuesday, another app.
Everybody who's listening, anybody who's listening, you know, we are in the holiday season. We are in sort of the giving season. I don't care who it is that you may volunteer with or give to, I do want you to consider seriously reaching out and helping an organization. Working Wardrobe would be wonderful. Go to their website. I'm sure there's opportunities to donate, or whoever in your local area that may be of need, and take this opportunity this season to actually give of yourself in that way.
That is the most beautiful comment. And ladies and gentlemen, it's not just for Tuesday. It's for any day.
Well,
Exactly.
7 days a week.
And on that note, I think, you know, just keep giving. Thank you, Jerry, for giving for 25 years and continuing to give. And we'll definitely be having you back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos. Brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue.